very generous introduction, and thank you all for your hospitality. It's a pleasure to be here. I understand some of you have read one of the papers that I'm going to be talking about today around rewilding and the rewilding experiments at the Jordbruksklassen, but I want to set that paper in a slightly broader context and in some ways to pick up on some of the themes that I develop in the book to bring ideas of rewilding into conversation with debates about the Anthropocene and this somewhat contested but quite generative concept of the Anthropocene. So maybe I'll start there. I guess most of you have come across the Anthropocene as a concept, yeah? So the Anthropocene is a hypothesis put forward by geologists that the magnitude of human impacts on the planet mean that we should really be describing ourselves as living in a new epoch, that the Holocene has come to an end, and that we should be describing a new epoch termed the Anthropocene. There is an international commission who have been assembled to adjudicate as to whether or not we are in the Anthropocene. They were supposed to report this year. They've been given another year to arrive at their decision. But it's fair to say that the genie is out of the bottle. You know, the term has spread widely. It's used broadly across a wide array of disciplines in the arts, in the humanities, as well as in the sciences. Many of you will be aware of the high-profile series of events they had at the Haus der Kultur der Welt in Berlin around the Anthropocene. And the Anthropocene itself has, I think, for me, initiated a series of really interesting conversations around nature cultures, to the extent that really whatever the geologists say, they're not going to be able to reclaim the term, I don't think. Many people would say we're living in the Anthropocene regardless of what the outcome is. But this is, I guess, the familiar periodization that we learn at high school or secondary school. The Holocene, the last 10,000 years or so from the end of the last glacial period, the Anthropocene would come right there at the end. The point at which the Anthropocene starts is really the point of contention amongst the geologists. Most people would pin it to what gets called the Great Acceleration after the Second World War, a series of radical transformations in our use of resources, particularly our use of fossil fuels, that are mapped out in a series of graphs here. Doesn't matter so much what the labels are, but there's a common set of spikes that take place that you would be able to find laid down in the fossil record. Others have suggested we might pin it to the invention of plastic. This was an article in the New Scientist talking about the dawn of the Pleistocene, that we might have an era termed the Pleistocene. More critical commentators would link it to capitalism and talk about the Capitalocene. There was a paper in Science recently that talked about the Plantationocene and would want to link the Anthropocene to colonial expansion into particularly parts of South America and the subsequent large-scale population die-offs that led to the reforestation of that continent, which you could find a signature of in the climate record. So it's very contested. Whether or not they'll arrive at the definitive indicator is unclear, but my take on it is that the Anthropocene is here, it's here to stay, and it's having a very generative effect on academic conversations at the interdisciplinary interface between nature and culture. In the book, I'm most interested in the implications of the Anthropocene for environmentalists. Now, in some ways, the Anthropocene might not seem such a radical proposal to environmentalists who have been talking about human impacts on places in the planet for a long period of time. We're steeped in this type of imagery. This is an advert from the World Wildlife Fund in which we have a Tarzan-type figure swinging through the tropical rainforest, encountering the clear-cut with the, you know, the visual indicators of modern life here and here. And this is bad news. Yeah, this is what a lot of environmentalism has staked its claim around, is, you know, mapping local human impacts upon planetary systems and campaigning for their protection. Okay. What's interesting for me about the Anthropocene is it brings to the end a particular way of thinking about nature that's been very central to environmentalism. Okay, so a lot of environmentalism has been premised on a separation between nature and society. An idea that you can find pure places that are set aside or can be set aside from human impacts. We can draw lines around them And in so doing, we can save nature. We can hold nature stable, we can purify it, we can hold it fast. And that is, to a certain extent, what environmentalism, particularly nature conservation, is supposed to do. Now, way back in the late 1980s, Bill McKibben, who's a popular North American science writer, talked about how climate change brought that idea of nature to an end. So Bill McKibben writing about how, you know, the global implications of climate change mean that there's nowhere left on the planet which is now untouched by human hands. So for McKibben, you know, steeped to a certain extent in a North American wilderness tradition, climate change, the human signature on atmospheric carbon, now means that nature is gone. Nature is dead, nature has come to an end. And for him, this was a point of great crisis, a point of great mourning, and, you know, in some ways a real crisis for environmentalism. Certainly, the Anthropocene, if we accept the premise that there is nowhere left on Earth that is now untouched by human hands, threatens some very powerful popular imaginations of nature that we would find in popular culture. So in the UK, we are raised on a tradition of David Attenborough, on those, you know, high-profile blue-chip wildlife documentaries, where David Attenborough takes us to wonderful parts of the world, which are largely without people. So many of you will have come across his latest series, Africa, in which people are somewhat evacuated from Africa. Africa becomes a place of magnificent wildlife. It becomes a place with a few, you know, traditional people wearing traditional clothing, but certainly Africa isn't a place with lots of people and modern life and cities and all the rest of it. Now, that imagination is very central to African conservation. The Anthropocene really questions that notion that there is a kind of Africa out there untouched by human hands. Now, of course, many people have been critical of that idea of Africa out there for a long period of time, but it brings those criticisms for me into the public domain. It allows us to have a serious conversation with scientists about the problems of taking Attenborough's idea of you know, nature seriously. In Europe and certainly in the UK, we're less obsessed with wilderness and the absence of people. We tend to be more obsessed with countryside before industrial agriculture. I imagine it's similar in Germany, but certainly in the UK, the National Trust, which is our biggest non-governmental organization, it has 3 million members, bigger than any political party, has an income of over £1 billion, it has as its icon the English oak, which is a species of, you know, lowland agricultural systems. We get obsessed with hedgerows, fields, sheep, etc., etc. Nature for many people in the UK is a feudal pre-modern landscape untouched by the ravages of industrial civilization, industrial agriculture. Okay, so it's different, but in some ways similar. It's a nature that's set aside from modern society. It's something that we can draw lines around. We can subsidize farmers to protect and keep it as such. So the Anthropocene really challenges those ideas of nature for me. It really challenges the idea that you can draw lines on the map, you can hold things stable, you can stop time, you can stop ecological processes, and you can stop human impacts. And ecologists are thinking about things differently now as well. So this isn't just a group of social scientists who say new scientists have got it all wrong. There's increasing discussion in ecological circles about this concept of novel ecosystems. So a whole different ontology, if you like, a different way of thinking about what the world is made up of, based on the idea that humans are key drivers of planetary systems. And we need to start talking about novel ecosystems which have been rearranged by human activities, be that accelerated climate change, or as this diagram wants to illustrate, the networks of global transportation that have led to massive redistributions of species out with the areas that they evolved within. So, you know, discussions about alien species or invasive species are very central to the notion of novel ecosystems. And the argument for the Anthropocene is that we need to think about conservation in novel ecosystems where we can't go back to some pure past, and in which humans are very much part of the ecological drivers of any ecology. Secondly, of course, the Anthropocene challenges the relationship between science and politics that was very central to nature conservation. So this is E.O. Wilson, one of the most influential figures behind biodiversity, which was a political program that came to the fore in the late 1980s and 1990s. It led to the Convention on Biodiversity at the Rio Summit in the early 90s. And for E.O. Wilson, He's a great believer in the power of science, the power of reason. You know, his hope was that if we do the science right, we show people about the ecological and economic significance of biodiversity, we provide the politicians with the facts, policy will follow. You know, a kind of very fundamentally modern understanding of the relationship between science and policy that, this is a diagram I take from Bruno Latour, that Latour is very critical of, this notion that science can be separated from politics, set outside of politics, and that, you know, the scientists should lead the way in telling us what nature is. They can reveal a singular nature and tell politicians what ought to happen. And of course, what we've seen in the Anthropocene is the fundamental entanglements between science and politics, be it around biodiversity, be it around climate, be it around this peculiar enthusiasm we have in the UK for killing and saving badgers. This is Brian May, who was the guitarist from Queen, who's now emerged as the main advocate to stop the badger cull in the UK. So there's this odd entanglement between celebrity musician, charismatic species, opposition between animal welfareists and farmers. Nowhere in any of these stories can we find a kind of nature that's pure and untouched. In all of these situations, there are various authorities who would claim to speak on behalf of nature with very different epistemological foundations. And for me, you know, the second major issue around the Anthropocene is this notion of multiple natural knowledges. There's lots of people who would claim to speak for nature. There isn't a pure nature to which we can easily attribute one sort of form of knowledge that would trump all of the others. This has come to the fore most recently in discussions in conservation. Some of you might have come across the Eco-Modernist Manifesto, which is a sort of ramped up form of market environmentalism that is trying to see the Anthropocene as a new opportunity for a kind of market environmentalism. It's there in some of Emma Maris's writings. She's a popular science writer who has a great book about novel ecosystems and thinking about conservation after the Anthropocene. But there's still a kind of business as usual. We need more science and more technology. Then there's the North American wilderness tradition, who are quite opposed to giving up on nature and would like to defend a position for wilderness in debates around conservation. Okay. That's quite a lengthy introduction to get to the book that I've just written, which is trying to kind of think through that political moment at the present and suggest that we need at least three different things in conservation. So we need a new understanding of nature, a new ontology, a new theory of what the world is made of. Associated with that, a new understanding of science. How do we do science when there are multiple natures? And then thirdly, a new understanding of politics, which recognises the multiple forms of expertise that might come to the fore if you've got multiple ways of thinking about nature. I can't talk about all of those things, but what I want to do is to try and develop some of those themes in the context of rewilding. Okay. So the second buzzword I guess I'm talking about today is rewilding. Has that also got some familiarity here? But maybe less so. So rewilding is a new approach to conservation that's, you know, coming through partly as a response to thinking about novel ecosystems, but also as part of a wider paradigm shift that's underway in ecology. Most commonly associated, perhaps, with this notion of trophic cascades within ecosystems. So the idea that some species have disproportionate ecological influence in the organization of a particular landscape, and that their absence has cascading effects down a food chain. So in Yellowstone, in North America, they reintroduced the wolf. The wolf had gone extinct. Largely, I think, because people loved wolves, but it transpired that the wolves had massive landscape-scale effects upon the grazing behavior of elk and bison, which then had even more significant effects upon the vegetation dynamics of Yellowstone. So they talked about wolves creating this ecology of fear. It wasn't just that wolves ate lots of elk, it's that they chased them differently, elk started grazing differently, and the whole landscape changed as a result of a small pack of wolves being reintroduced. So there's this notion of keystone species, key species that can return processes into particular landscapes. We haven't quite come to reintroduce wolves in Europe, though wolves are returning. I imagine you've probably got wolves around here at the moment. I mean, I know they made it into the Netherlands. But in Europe, we've become more excited about grazing, about returning grazing animals that were the previously big drivers of the ecologies of temperate forests in northern Europe, particularly cows and horses. So cows and horses that we have are descended from, you know, the aurochs and the tarpan, which are now extinct. But the argument is that modern cattle and modern horses are close enough that they could be used as surrogate species to instigate grazing regimes, naturalistic grazing regimes, in place of these animals. There are a range of historical benchmarks that inform this. So Rewilding North America, which was a paper published in Science in 2006, gave this quite graphic illustration of what was there 10,000 years ago, and proposed that you could find surrogate species for some of the species that are now extinct. So you could introduce a giraffe in North America in place of some of these other grazing animals which are now extinct. You could bring African lions to North America. You could even bring African elephants to North America with ecological reasons, because they would perform ecological functions that are now absent. So it's very much playing with this idea of a novel ecosystem. There's no historical precedent for an African elephant in North America, but they're close enough, people say, that they would do important ecological things down the line. So you've got this interesting temporality. You've got various pasts being invoked to justify future interventions. In Europe, there's an organization called Rewilding Europe, which has gained quite a lot of money and political traction to sketch out a kind of vision of the rewilding of marginal areas of Europe. They see quite a lot of opportunity in the growing land abandonment associated with the reform of the common agricultural policy, particularly in areas of Central and Eastern Europe. And they have this sort of vision of Europe inhabited by these charismatic species. Interestingly, pretty much where we are now is the only place where people are allowed to live, by the look of things, and the rest of Europe is kind of given over to these large and charismatic beasts. So you can imagine there's some controversies around that vision. If you're a marginal farmer in upland areas in Europe, you might be a bit anxious about this chap emerging, these kind of things. In the UK, rewilding's really come to the fore as a result of George Monbiot, who is a very charismatic columnist in the Guardian newspaper, wrote this book, which is sort of part travelogue, part midlife crisis, part manifesto for rewilding the UK. He's about to launch a big foundation called Rewilding Britain, which he wants to, he gives these great TED talks in which he talks about bringing back elephants to the UK. He argues that all these hedgerow species we have in the UK work because they're used to being bashed and abused by elephants. And the existence of hawthorn and other trees shows that elephants are an important part of our ecology, and really we should have elephants back in the UK. He's not going to get elephants, but he might get beavers, which I imagine are fairly common around here, but beavers are extinct in the UK. There's interest in the lynx and a kind of growing political momentum around rewilding in the UK. The example that I'm most interested in, that I've studied in a project with Clemens Driessen, who's a philosopher now based at Wageningen in the Netherlands, is the Oostvaardersplassen, or what is termed by some the Serengeti behind the dikes. Has anybody been to the Oostvaardersplassen? No? Okay. So the Oostvaardersplassen is on the Flevoland, which is the largest artificial island in the world. So it was an area of the Netherlands that was reclaimed from the sea in the 1950s. It's just outside Amsterdam here. It's one of the main commuter rail lines that goes up to Almere here, runs right along the edge of it. This is what it looks like from the air. So we're here. If we zoom in, you get a sense of what the predominant land use is around there. So it's largely agricultural, it's largely suburban. This site was going to be used as an oil refinery, but they never quite got the drainage right, so it was abandoned and left for natural processes to take over. It's a mixture of dry and wet land. It's largely stabilized, so there's a dike that runs along here. This is about 2 to 3 meters below sea level. The water levels change a little bit, but they pump it to keep it dry. So it's a kind of, it's a wild site, but it's very much in the heart of a, huge industrial reclamation project that is, kept in a certain condition by human technology. The Oostvaardersplassen is most associated with the Dutch paleoecologist and bureaucrat Frans Vera. So Vera was very involved in first recognizing the ecological significance of this site and in campaigning for its preservation. There have been various points in time where they wanted to develop it. But also, Vera, by virtue of studying the ecology of this site, so what was interesting about this site is you would expect it to be quickly taken over by woodland species. You know, that's what we tend to think of as the successional model of temperate areas in the UK and in Europe. You know, woodland species take over and you get a kind of closed canopy forest as the outcome. What happened at the Ursvallesplatsen was that the grey-lag geese arrived and their grazing kept the landscape open. They prevented the trees taking over. And Vera studied this quite extensively for his PhD, and on the back of it he proposed a very radical alternative idea of what the paleoecology of Europe should be like. So much paleoecology assumes that, you know, a place like this, before the university was built, before people arrived, would be a closed canopy forest, you know, lots of mature woodlands, very little open space. And Vera suggested that that model had neglected the importance of large herbivores, particularly cattle, horses, bison, and that if they were there, we would have had a much more open landscape. He talks about a shifting mosaic of forest, pasture, landscapes. Now, a lot of conservation policy in Europe is largely about preserving landscapes, preserving forests in the absence of large herbivores. And Vera suggested that we were funding the wrong type of landscape intervention, and instead we needed to think about reintroducing these large herbivores and their ecological dynamics, because that would produce a better, richer, more ecologically diverse European countryside. And the Ursvallesplatsen became the experimental site for him to test this hypothesis. So there were geese there, but no cattle and horses, obviously, and no deer. So he got some deer from the local forest. He gathered hardy breeds of cattle and horses, and they were released onto the site. And the idea was that they would be allowed to de-domesticate themselves. They would go wild with limited human intervention. They were stuck in there and really left to their own devices. So we have these Koenig ponies, which are a sort of traditional hardy breed of Polish pony, and Heck cattle, which were backbred in Germany in the 1920s and the 1930s and are recognized as a very hardy breed of cattle. So they were stuck in there, left to their own devices. It's fair to say many paleoecologists doubt Vera's hypothesis, and the Ursvallesplatsen has not confirmed one way or the other whether this is the correct interpretation of what the paleoecology should be. Now, it obviously requires a very long time frame, but what it has done is thrown up some really interesting ecological surprises. So, yeah, there's nowhere else in Europe where large herds of cattle and horses are allowed to graze, you know, interact without some form of human management. So you get very interesting invertebrate life, you get very interesting vegetation life, but also there's a lot of dead animals lying around on the landscape. So you get this kind of return of the carrion feeding birds and the wild boar, if they would allow them to be there, which are kind of ecological processes that we don't see much of in the European landscape. So the sea eagle, which is the, you know, the black and white eagle that is one of the very charismatic birds in Europe, returned to the Netherlands. They hadn't had it in the Netherlands for a long period of time, but it returned to the Netherlands and it nested below sea level, which has obviously never happened historically, that a sea eagle would nest below sea level. Nobody predicted it, nobody said it would happen. So these are sort of interesting ecological surprises that happen. Vultures returned to the Netherlands briefly. It got hit by a train and died, and they haven't come back since. But there's this sort of notion that if you let these surprising things happen, you know, new ecologies come to the fore. It's also been a very controversial project, primarily because of the tensions with the animal welfarists over letting these formerly domesticated animals die in captivity. So there's been a lot of politics around the management of the site, a lot of conflict also with conservationists who don't like the idea of giving up on traditional agricultural systems and letting these large herbivores roam around. And to a certain extent, some conflict with people concerned about biosecurity, because you've got these, you know, dead animal bodies lying around the landscape, which could potentially be reservoirs for disease, you know, particularly into the Dutch pig industry and areas like that. So a series of controversies around this site. Okay. So what I want to do is to try and think through this example of the Ursvallesplatsen, this, you know, in some ways exemplary idea of rewilding, for how it offers new ideas about nature in the Anthropocene. In the paper, which is entitled Wild Experiments, we try and think through how we might make sense of the Jus Veritas Person by comparing two different models of science. Caricatured comparisons between a model of laboratory science and a model of field science, which have different political and epistemic practices associated with them. And what's very interesting about the Jus Veritas Person is it tries to be both a laboratory and a field site. And in reconciling the characteristics of those two, it arrives at quite a different way of thinking about what nature is in the Anthropocene. So I'll try and work that through, but these are some of the differences that we talk about in the paper. So, you know, laboratories are premised on the idea that they are artificial. They allow the scientists to control the conditions of knowledge generation. They are made sites. Field sites, the Serengeti, have, you know, significance because they are wild, they are untouched. So there's this distinction between the domestic and the wild. In theory, stuff you do in the laboratory should not have consequences outside of the laboratory. You know, you should be able to bound the operations of your scientific experiments. Clearly, anything you do in the field is going to overflow and escape. In the field site, it's very difficult to bound the field site. And field sites are public spaces. It's very difficult to get an exclusive field site in the way that laboratory allows the scientists to control access, control who gets to say on decision-making. So on the one hand, Franz Wierer and others presented the Jus Veritas Person as a laboratory. This was an artificial site that was owned by the Dutch government. It was a place in which they could experiment. It was a place in which they could introduce cattle and horses. They could control the drainage. They could do a series of controlled modifications, largely without public consultation, in order to test out what was going on. But at the same time, in order for the findings of the Jus Veritas Person to have legitimacy elsewhere, in order that other people in other parts of Europe might look at that and say, wow, you know, they could do it there, let me do that in my field site, they had to also make it seem as though these were naturalistic processes. So they weren't things that were done by humans and dependent on human intervention, they were things done by the animals. So the accounts that we get of the Jus Veritas Person are somewhat conflicted. On the one hand, this is nature development. This is, you know, Dutch engineering at its finest. You know, we've managed to tame nature and control it. But at the same time, it's also a story about the surprising emergence of the geese, the surprising ecological activities of the horses and the deer. This is the Serengeti behind the dikes. This is the kind of story about, you know, surprising ecological dynamics. But at the same time, there were lots of anxieties about the ethics of leaving these large herbivores to die in captivity. So, you know, comparisons were made to, you know, situations of animal captivity, and the implication being that these animals should be subject to the same forms of ethical care that we associate with the farm or even with the laboratory. Okay, so if you're framing the Jus Veritas Person as a laboratory and you're sticking animals in it, then surely they argue you should have, you know, standards of animal welfare you associate with the laboratory. If it's the Serengeti, then of course there's a very different framework of animal care associated with the Serengeti. We're not worried about, you know, individual animals dying in the Serengeti. We're worried about, you know, species dying out. In the laboratory, of course, or even in the farm, we're very anxious about individual animal welfare, and we, you know, we have a responsibility towards that. There was a court case in which you know, the judge was asked to decide on whether or not these animals, the cattle and horses, were wild or not. Really, there's a sort of binary model of animal care available to us. Either they are agricultural animals or they're wild animals, and, you know, one or other is necessary. Now, in Dutch law, that distinction comes down to a question of ownership, comes down to a question of whether these animals can actually be held. There's an interesting kind of phenomenology to it. If you can hold your animal, then you own it, and therefore you have a legal responsibility to look after it. Now, these animals are, you know, are not used to human contact. They're big and they're dangerous, and they've been encouraged to be so. And so the judge found that actually these animals couldn't be held, and therefore they were no longer the legal property of Stats Bosbeheer, who are the Dutch conservation organization. So the judge in the court case found in the favor of the rewilders, but it was such a public relations disaster. You know, these were charismatic animals dying in the suburbs, you know, in full view of a commuter rail line, that something had to be done. So, as tends to be the case in these situations, an international commission was assembled. Lots of worthy scientists and ethicists from around the world were gathered, and they produced a series of reports to try and arrive at a reconciliation, a situation that could move between the lab and the field, that could find some middle ground between you know, later in society to a certain extent. And what they've arrived at is a really, for me, interesting compromise. So at the moment, as it stands, they have a model of controlling the populations of these herbivores where the ranger has to assess the welfare of the animals with the eye of the wolf. Okay. So there's a notion that the ranger can become wolf and assess the population dynamics and the individual welfare of animals. If they are seen to not be in a condition where they would survive the winter, they are shot and the carcasses are disposed of. So it's this sort of shuttling between, you know, the ethics of the hunter, the ethics of the wild, and then this very kind of, you know, scientific procedural framework for controlling population. Now, unfortunately, we don't know very much about what wild cows and horses do in the presence of wolves. It's not studied much. When they last coexisted, there weren't many people around. So the criteria that they use for assessing whether or not these cows and horses are, you know, suitable prey for chasing by wolves, they borrow from farming, where there's lots of, you know, systems available for scoring the welfare of cattle. So you're sort of borrowing technologies from the lab to bring out into the field, where the wolf has to be able to kind of assess the farming handbook on, you know, animal behavior in this sort of way. So there's this, you know, intriguing shuttling between the wild and the domestic. You know, and when we speak to these people, they're very open about this. You know, it's not about any kind of pure nature. You know, this is a fudge. This is a practical solution that we're getting at. Because we want to preserve the population dynamics and the social behavior of these animals. By and large, it works so far. The big issue, of course, is that this is a bounded reserve. It's 5,000 hectares. The population has grown dramatically. There aren't any predators. There aren't really any reasons that the population, you know, wouldn't continue to expand. Now, some, including Franz Vera, suggest that, you know, if there isn't enough food, the animals stop breeding. But the animal welfare is suggesting that they'll keep breeding otherwise, and this will be a, you know, it's an indefinite problem. They'd like to expand the site, but it's, you know, as you could see from the map, there's nowhere else to go. So it's not perfect, but this eye of the wolf type model and the kind of particular understanding of nature behind it, I think we could draw some broader lessons out for how we think about environmentalism in the Anthropocene. So in the paper, we developed this concept of the wild experiment, and there are three different components to that. I've already talked about this distinction between the found and the made. What's interesting about the Urswelles person is it also has this very different way of doing science. It's very much interested in emergent properties, in generating surprises, rather than in, you know, knowing exactly what nature was and managing towards it, which tends to be what, you know, reserve management is in many conservation areas. It's okay, well, let's stick these animals in and see what happens. We don't really have an action plan. We don't really have any targets. You know, interesting things are going to happen along the way. And then the paper, we also talk about the political dimension of this. Now, this is in many ways a very bad example to take as a positive way of thinking about public engagement around environmental controversies. You know, this was a very, you know, delegative model. The scientists knew what they wanted. They were doing it in their bounded reserve. There was little public consultation. When the public, you know, various publics got angry about animal welfare, they were dismissed, they were patronized, etc., etc. And only gradually have they come around to a more, you know, in some ways, engaged dialogical model of doing public engagement as a result of a series of controversies. So in contrast, perhaps, to some of the examples that Sarah Watmore was talking about in her talk about knowledge controversies around flooding, this isn't really where I would suggest we start if we're thinking about controversial interventions like, you know, introducing wolves, let's say. Okay. So where does this take us if we start to think about wildlife after nature? Okay, so in the broad discussions around the Anthropocene, as I was suggesting at the start, there are these quite extreme versions of what should happen emerging. So on the right-hand side, you have a kind of eco-modernist story about one final leap, one, you know, better body of science, better technology, better markets. Humans can achieve their destiny, their enlightenment destiny as the god species. We can domesticate the planet once and for all, and we will, you know, we will settle that problem. We could, you know, find that in groups like the Breakthrough Institute. Mark Lanas is one of their fellows, you know, coming out of North America, very optimistic, very sort of techno driven form of ecological modernization. On the other side, we have, you know, people read this book, Alan Wiseman. It's a very interesting thought experiment. He imagines that humans go extinct. He doesn't really talk about how that happens, and then looks at what happens to the planet after people disappear, you know, how various ecological processes would return. But the subtext behind his writing, and quite a lot of that apocalyptic North American writing, is that wouldn't be such a bad thing, you know. And in some ways, the Anthropocene is the kind of eco-rapture. This is the kind of moment, you know, we've been, you know, asking for. You know, destruction is coming, apocalypse is coming, and we will return to some kind of primitivist civilization. So the two extremes, you know, and there are many points in the middle. But what if we look at the Jungfernsprache, we can start to find some, you know, somewhere in between these two versions of how we think about nature culture in the Anthropocene. So we get this sense that there are multiple natures out there. There are multiple hybrid ontologies. In the Jungfernsprache example, you've got folk very concerned about species. You know, it's about the species of insects or animals that are living there. Individual animals don't matter so much, but they are necessary as kind of ecological drivers for the system. So you've got two there, different ontologies, two ways of cutting up what nature is. There are a range of historical benchmarks that you can make reference to for rewilding, but clearly the past isn't going to be like the future, so you've got to kind of use these to guide what's going on as ecological systems emerge. These are impure systems. You know, if purity is about the absence of people, then these are fundamentally, you know, places in which we have a signature, and some of us have much greater signatures than others. They are imminent in the sense that they are always doing surprising things. There's no balance in this system. It's not a kind of timeless balance of nature. And they're also everywhere. You know, the nice thing about the Jungfernsprache is it's in the suburbs. It's not out in some far-flung national park full of, you know, charismatic, you know, mountains and all the rest of it. It's, you know, it's here in the interstices, in the mixture of, you know, of where nature is. What we'd hope is that we could arrive at a politics premised on a recognition of multiple forms of natural knowledge. So, you know, the hallowed position of the scientist as somehow outside of society, somehow able to arrive at a singular notion of nature, doesn't hold. And we need to think about ways of bringing science into society, bringing science into politics, to recognize the multiple forms of natural knowledge associated with conservation. And what's interesting, if we start to think about the ethics of this, is that we could, you know, try and map out some of those fundamental tensions in environmental ethics between an ethics based on individual animals and an ethics based on the flourishing of species populations. You know, and again, the Jungfernsprache example tries to square that circle, you know, where there was a recognition that individual animal suffering mattered, as well as a recognition that they wanted to preserve the possibility for horses to be horses in large herds, cows to be cows in large herds in that way. So it's kind of grappling with those very thorny philosophical issues. Okay, so in many ways, the event of the Anthropocene is a disaster, but it's also a very interesting conceptual opportunity for folk in the humanities, in the social sciences, to start to have the types of conversations you guys have been having here around the nature-culture interface. Environmentalism clearly needs to change. It can't make recourse to this notion of pure nature, and it is changing pretty fast in many different directions. The future will not be like the past, and I guess we can all, you know, we're all warned about that every day, but there's still a tendency in conservation to imagine a return, to imagine the re of rewilding is, you know, is probably necessary, but it's somewhat, you know, I think somewhat duplicitous maybe to imagine that we're going to rewild rather than just wilding. You know, there's nothing that we can go back to in that way. And that multiple futures and natures are possible. And if multiple future natures are possible, then what the planet becomes is a political as well as an ecological process, and that, you know, various groups of people need to be involved in that deliberation and in the politics around that. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. Thank you.